I'll just give you sort of a general introduction and a general rationale for this show. I'm not exactly sure how familiar you are with Elizabeth's work. Probably most people are somewhat, maybe some people quite a lot. But the reason doing this exhibition was that Elizabeth is, at 65, an artist with a very long history, of which only really about a decade is well known. She had a retrospective of sorts, or I should say mid-career, that was done by Kathy Halbrecht, then of the MIT Center List and now at the Walker Art Center, director, and Sue Graves from Dallas, that came to the Whitney in 1988. And it was essentially a summary of what she'd done from about 1980, 79, maybe, 81, till that time. And it was paintings that you will see in the core of this exhibition. And it was done at the tail end of the sort of 80s moment when painting was back. There was a show called The New Spirit of Painting in London at the Royal Academy, which was one of the kicker offers of this, which sort of declared that after the decade of the 70s, when there was much experimentation in new media, installation, performance, video, et cetera, painting was resurgent. And of course, it was a time when there was an enormous amount of attention paid to a handful, virtually all of them, which is the neo-expressionist moment and so on. So Elizabeth's show came at the tail end of that moment and dealt with a very important body of her work. But except for those of her friends who knew the work prior to that, and you'll see in the first couple of rooms works that she made in the decade before, many of which are owned by artist friends of hers by exchange and so on, almost nobody knew where she came from. And then, of course, after 88, a lot happened of a very dramatic variety, which was seen by people who frequented her exhibitions at Paula Cooper, and then later on at Pace Gallery, but it was not work that was generally known in this country. It was not work that was generally written up in this country. It was the unfolding of something that was very dramatic and extremely important in terms of what is possible and available to painting nowadays, but it was, again, information that was not held this time by a happy few, but by a relatively happy few, a somewhat larger happy few, a New York audience. So the reason for making this exhibition is the reason basically that the moment exists at all, which is to take the information that is held by people who watch the scene closely and make it part of a general public discussion about what art can be, what art can do, and to, you know, sort of bind audiences together that might otherwise not meet each other, and to make work flow in that context. The other thing, of course, is to tacitly to insert it in art history. This is the museum that has the single greatest collection of modern art anywhere, and that is not chauvinism since I no longer work here. It's just a statement of fact. Other museums may catch up in certain areas. They may actually be better in certain areas as we approach the present, but in terms of the overall span of art history, there is really no museum which equals it. And for a long time, the description of the mainstream of art that this museum seemed to be dedicated to, I say seemed only because it was an interpretation of the 1960s and 70s, promulgated by Bill Rubin and others, but not necessarily what others prior to that, was a relatively strong version of what actually happened in modernism. And in particular, the protagonist that was seemingly the center of attention from the 1960s onwards, really from 59 onwards, was Frank Stella. And almost all of the discussion about certain sets of possibilities in painting either went to him or Warhol, Johns, and other people representing Neo-Dada and Pop. Murray should be inserted into that history, related to what Debbie Wallace, the pattern by injecting somebody in who in fact had been there all along, who had been working all along, but whose work had not been calculated into the sort of general description of art. That if you live into this situation, I think you will find that there are clearly alternative visions to what is possible in painting based on her work, just on her work in relation to Stella, in relation to. If you read her work and then what happened through her work, is predicated on the options. You can tell me whether I succeed. I find that Elizabeth has a lot to offer no matter the premise of the show. I think we should probably do is move into the describe and that part. think, again, if you sort of spread out this way, we can pretty much fit each other, fit ourselves in here, not each other, but ourselves, plural. It's apparently not meant to work. Apparently it's recording for the camera, but not for you. So I just have to bellow, that's all. Mm-hmm. And they'll have to turn me down once they start doing the recording. And the other thing is, if the people in the back near the door come all the way in, because if you step back, the doors will spasmodically open and close. This room basically is a very, very cursory description of about 10 or 15 years worth of work. It begins in that sketchbook from 1963 with work that she did just out of graduate school, or even in graduate school, in Mills College in California. Prior to that, she had been a student at the Art Institute in Chicago. And then subsequent to that, she took a series of teaching jobs. When she was in Mills College, she basically discovered New York long distance through the reverse telescope. And in particular, she recalls having seen one of the first issues of Art Forum, which was published at that time on the West Coast, with images of the work of Warhol and of Johns and others, of which she had been then unaware. And so she moved back eastward by way of Buffalo and got to New York in 1967. So what you have in this room, as I say, is a sort of synoptic version of that. But just to give you some sense of the texture and the detail, that little sketchbook contains a lot of drawings in a lot of different styles, all of them of the same hand, between abstract kind of invention of shapes and forms, descriptive drawings of the figure, drawings of anatomy, hypothetical drawings of anatomy, where some of the organs that you will later find in her paintings are cursorily or preliminarily described. You have what I opened the page to, a wonderful double page spread of a pair of man's shorts, which become a kind of emblem of the patterning and abstraction that would later be the case, although at that time most of the rest of it is quite figurative. It's in a funk idiom, basically speaking. It's a kind of pop, a slang pop rather than a cool pop. But in any case, in 1963, she was doing all of that, and you have to recall that in 1962, Warhol painted his Dick Tracy painting. And there's, in fact, a page out of a Dick Tracy cartoon which is pulled out of the newspaper and then redrawn by Elizabeth. So as a very young woman in California, not New York, but after all, pop was an international phenomenon. It was not just New York. She was already in touch with exactly the same kind of sources, thinking about exactly the same ideas and doing them in her own voice or in her own manner. Then you have a painting from about, I don't know the exact date, but something like 64, 65, over there maybe 66, called Mirror, which reflects both, again, the developing forms of her own and also her response to people like Red Grooms and Krauss Oldenburg, which is to say the kind of pop which was hands-on, which was painterly, what Paul Schimmel called in a show that he once did, hand-painted pop, the kind of pop that was not in imitation of reproductive media, but used images from the media, but then reinterpreted them or rephrased them in a manner that was gestural, that was textural, that had weight and mass and kind of hands-on strangeness to it. And you can see her playing with the internal frame. She's actually got a second molding on there. There are bits here also of early cubism rephrased in a vernacular pop. Next over, a little later, 67, I believe, is a painting which is stenciled, which uses spray paint, which uses the pattern of printed fabrics of a kind that you might have for pajamas or children's sheets. And by 1969, she actually was a mother, so this is a thing that is part of her reality very shortly. But it's a very interesting statement about where she was again. If in 63 she was doing her kind of pop with only a slight lag behind the original pop artist, I mean as a matter of a year or two, by this time she's exactly where Sigmar Polka was at this time, or actually a little ahead of him. And there's a painting that's reproduced in the catalog of a skyscraper with a spray-painted background, with a stenciled image, with curved corners and so on and so forth, which is his interpretation of the same set of problems, and without, in fact, using these kind of fabric patterns, which he came to a little bit later, which is only to say that although Elizabeth didn't really surface until the mid to late 1970s as an artist, she was right in there grappling with this kind of material. So a lot of the issue of where one is and whether one gets credit for it is whether anybody knows about it, not whether or not one was actually doing it. And I'm trying to make a very quick case for the fact that she was actually doing it independently of people with whom she would now be associated as a second tier, second generation, whatever. These three paintings basically show a progression. They were made in New York. as I said, by 1969, she was a mother. Much of the time, she raised her son on her own, so she was a mother juggling job, child, and the job was teaching art for not a great deal of money. Richard Kramer and I used to teach art for not very much money, so he knows about this. Anyway, so he was juggling all of that, and she began to look back over some options that she had discovered when she was a student. When she came to the Art Institute in Chicago, she came from a relatively small Illinois city to the big city. She was there by the grace of her art teacher, who discreetly subsidized her education. She did not know this, but she went to a place that cost money and she had none, with a scholarship that her high school art teacher had actually provided for her, and the encouragement to take it, and went there with the intention of becoming a commercial artist, which was pretty much the only option for somebody in her situation. And of course, this was the late 50s, and the options for women painters were very, very few and far between. If you think of Joan Mitchell at this time, she was breaking that barrier, as were a few other people, but there were very few. And Joan, of course, had private money, which made it a good deal easier. It was hard under any circumstances, but it made it easier. In any case, she came to Chicago, and when she got there, in those days, in order to get to classes, you had to walk through the galleries of the Institute. So you got an instant hands-on education from real works of art. And there she discovered de Kooning's excavation, she discovered the work of Juan Gris, she discovered the work of Picasso, of others that would be important to her, and there, most dramatically, perhaps, she discovered Cézanne. And the tactility of Cézanne, the sort of strange, anomalous situation spatially of Cézanne, the drama of Cézanne, the sort of very subdued sort of tension, if you will, in the pictures, a whole host of things attracted her, and she became a painter in large part in response to what Cézanne seemed to open up to her. Not least, by the way, although Elizabeth is not an awkward painter, and we get later into the gallery, she'll see very beautifully done drawings in a very, very adept variation of the kind of cartooning that comes out of Disney and elsewhere. She was also not immediately a facile painter. And Cézanne is a great encourager to artists who begin the hard way, if you will. And if you look at early Cézanne, the awkwardness is much of their poignancy. It is also the way in which he remade painting by not doing it the right way too easily and having to find his own way. Well, in a sense, Elizabeth was in a similar situation. So what you have here is three paintings. The first one is Madame Cézanne in a rocking chair. And she basically went back to the cartooning that she was interested in. And like many kids, shall we say, American kids, she began drawing in part by imitating the funny pages, the Sunday supplement and so on. So to go to the cartoon format where you gridded out a story was a natural thing to do. And you will find this in other people, or even Falstrom and so on, but not that many others actually did full cartoon strips. They tended to do single frames, which is what Warhol and Lichtenstein did. But here she does a narrative sequence, and there is Madame Cézanne patiently waiting for her portrait to be made. And after a while, she wearies, and then after a while, she plunges headfirst onto the floor. And after a while, she is beamed up through the window by I don't know what grace of God or the gods of art or what have you. But it's a parody on the long-suffering Mrs. Cézanne and her relation with her infinitely patient, exhausting, exacting husband. So it's an homage to the painting of the man, the situation of the woman, shall we say. The second step in this is she takes a detail out of Cézanne, which is the man on the right-hand side of the card players, the many different versions of it in the slouch hat, gives him a kind of, again, Chester Gould, Dick Tracy face, this kind of prune head, the chin, all the brow, all of these characters that are grotesquely wobbly and unstable and kind of slug-like, gives this head and then turns it modular. So you break out of the frame, the narrative frame here, and you repeat the image, but now you repeat the image for its variations as form. And you sort of set it into this field where there's a lot of other flux, which is patterned in a certain degree, and where the internal frame condenses and the external frame dilates, and you move it as an abstract variable within an abstract field. After which the head more or less disappears and only the hat remains. And in this painting you have the beginnings of a kind of cartoon modularity. You have, in essentially, minimalism allied to pop, in a case where it looks maybe like a rug pattern or what have you, but it is a further development, in relatively in a matter of a year or so, a further development towards what then takes up the most of the next two galleries, which is her response to minimalism. When she came to New York, doing this kind of work, as you see over there, and disinclined to do abstraction, and moreover disinclined to do a severe, systematic kind of abstraction, she gradually realized that minimalism posed a genuine challenge to the way she thought. Her best friend at that time, and still one of her very best friends, Jennifer Bartlett, whose painting that is over there, was one of the artists who was trying to grapple with minimalism in the same way. And if you know Jennifer's early work, she'd put down grids and then painted enamel, series of patterns and repetitions which had image qualities but that were basically abstract. Another friend was Bryce Martin, whose work she greatly respected. But these were all artists who were on the verge of being known, but by this time were really not known. Another was Bob Moskowitz, who is actually, comparatively speaking, better known than some of these other artists. So at a certain point, she basically said to herself, I must deal with this way of making art, but deal with it in my own manner. And so what you get around this corner into the next room are adaptations of the grid, where the grid stays in flux, where the hand is still present, where the mechanical draftsmanship, or at least the rigorous rule draftsmanship that was more the type in minimalism, is allowed to be broader, more obviously in flux, and where all kinds of slight anomalies intrude upon the regularities of which minimalism was made. And also, if you look at the little blue one, for example, which is a series of Fs lying on their back, you'll see how color intrudes, how the field is not a uniform color, but it blushes pink or green, if you can call a green thing a blush, and blues and so on. So an enormous amount of painterliness sort of slipped into what seems like a radical stripping down of painting relative to where she started. And in the space of sort of 63 to 70, not very long, it is an enormous trajectory, but all in her own voice. We can go around the bend. Now, if you know the way in which minimalist painting was done, and minimalism basically was a sculptural style. So when you use the term, we have to use it advisedly in relation to painting. But in any case, if you know generally how minimalist painting was, it was never, in fact, as rigid as its predecessors in Bauhaus, constructivism, etc. And indeed, in constructivism, it's not as rigid as it looks in reproduction, because if you look at Popova, if you look at Malevich, if you look at almost all the painters other than Rodchenko, it's not done with drafting tools. It's full of touch. It's full of edges which are sort of contested by both sides. It has color that you would not expect. There's lots of pink in Malevich. So, you know, the vision we have of constructivism is red, black, and blue, the sort of the Russian heroic colors, but there's actually pink and violet and cobalt green and other things floating around in there as well. In any case, the painterliness of Murray takes off from that in certain ways. Also in Agnes Martin, if you look at Agnes Martin, even though she sometimes uses a ruler, the hand wobbles, and also the pencil, if she's using a pencil, skips, or the brush, if she's using a brush, blots a little bit and disconnects. So there's always a degree of flux. But in the case of Murray, you see very soon after having gone through these early phases that she begins to actively push things around, which is a slightly different attitude. So if you look at 1, 2, 3 paintings based on the idea of steps or stairs, which is a sort of columnal version of minimalism. It's also, by the way, I suppose a nod to Brancusi and Carl Andre, or, you know, first Carl Andre nodded to Brancusi and then she nodded to both of them. But by the time you get to this wonderful orange painting, you see that she's beginning to literally push it around. She'll push a horizontal or a vertical in or out, and you begin to get an irregular, unstable columnar structure. Again, it's almost as if you looked at one of the sort of the peasant-ish looking Brancusi bases rather than the sort of live, beautifully even Brancusi things that are on top of the base. And here you can see much the same kind of thing happen. If you say that this is a grid, she's taking chunks, she's squeezing it, she's pulling it out. It's almost as if you took some kind of a jointed carpenter's tool and just moved it around until you got a shape, something of the kind that you wanted. Remember that at this time, first of all, already by 1961, 62, Frank Stella had taken the rectangle, and partly on Carl Andre's advice, had taken chunks out of the corner. That very shortly thereafter, Lawrence Wiener was beginning to chop corners out of his paintings, and also Robert Mangold was doing the same. So the idea of intruding on the rectangle and denting it and rearranging its symmetries in this fashion by subtraction almost was not alone, but the amount of graphic activity, the amount of erasure and correction, the sort of dynamism of all of this, and the element of genuine play, not cartoony cute play, but of the ability to put something in play so that it, in the literal a form can play, not like a child, but move between things, is very much in these drawings. And you can see here is a kind of circular version of the same thing, where she doesn't draw the perfect circle. If you think of Mangold, for example, at this time, in graphite or in charcoal, he would essentially try the old Renaissance trick of by hand making the perfect circle, often with an imperfect shape. So what you have is a much more physical kind of address, a much more aggressive attitude towards pushing it around, moving it around, changing it around. By the time you get over here, you can see what happens to all of that. And I'm going to give my little formalist spiel in about 1.5 minutes, which is the short form of a long argument. But it is at least my view of how one might really begin to see Elizabeth's unique place in the history of recent painting, as opposed to her relative place to the established record. These are Mobius strips, and it's called Mobius. And these are, in fact, a different kind of geometry than what we've been looking at. The grid geometries of minimalism and of all of the cubist antecedents to minimalism are involved in planes, Euclidean planes. And the idea basically is something on the order of this, that in the Renaissance you created a boxed out regular gridded space that described all the order that God intended, at least as so far as it was seen by the Italian artists who thought they knew what God was thinking. And then cubism came along and smacked that perfect boxed out universe, and it went into shards, basically. And then you could infinitely recombine these shards. But each one of them was a fragment of a plane, right? Each one of them was rigid and unidimensional, so to speak, even though it was a broken piece of a former whole. Topology, which is a different kind of mathematics, is involved in elasticities and involved in the continuities of surface. It's a surface rather than planar geometry. And a Mobius strip, as you all know, is a single-sided form which has three-dimensional properties. That's the paradox. No matter where you are on a Mobius strip, you're on the same surface as where you started, but a Mobius strip loops the loop in space. If you think of the sort of basic tenets of modernism, on one side you have cubism, and cubism is addressed to the old rigid order, and on the other side you have surrealism, which is often thought of in terms of biomorphism, of the ability to make a form that is a surrogate for a body part. Everything sort of begins to look like livers or internal organs. I'm not exactly sure what. Sometimes Dali will put little mustaches on them in inappropriate places. But in any case, the idea is a sort of direct metaphorical or representational version of a bodily thing. But the mathematics behind biomorphism is essentially topological. It's the idea that you can take a unit and bend and twist and knead and extend and so on and so forth, and so long as you don't actually rupture it, it remains the same thing. The basics of topology is something called homeostasis, which means that a form retains its integrity so long it is not perforated or torn. And you basically have in Elizabeth the shift from a geometry that is purely Euclidean to one which is partially or wholly topological. And the tug of war in her paintings from here on out is a tug of war between not just the style of surrealism, but the principles of surrealism and those of cubism. And if you think about shaped canvas painting up until this point, which is not just Frank Stella, it goes back to Charles Shaw, I think, as Bob Rosenblum pointed out early on, but it goes back to Madi in Latin America and Argentina during and just after the Second World War. There's a lot of shaped canvas painting. Virtually all of it is Euclidean. Virtually all of it is some version of Euclidean solids and how they are treated when they are broken. But this kind of thing, the continuous space of surrealism, was never made dimensional in painting before. And that's essentially what Elizabeth did. She found a way to, first of all, incorporate those principles in the making of the image. Secondly, to put those images in tension with those which were surrealist, the shattered picture with the continuous flow picture. And then ultimately, as you will see, to actually build structures to paint on that were topological in principle rather than planar. So that the image that you saw that was biomorphic inhabited a space which was built on the same principles. And that's sort of the progression gradually. I say this with one caveat. This is not what Elizabeth herself will say. Elizabeth came into the art world at a time when, as she said, people talked about issues. Frank Stella was always talking about issues. Everybody was talking about issues. Everybody was mostly guys. And since it was not allowed, basically, that a woman should intervene in this conversation anymore very much, and since she was not interested in declaring before she did it how she was going to intervene in history, Elizabeth has always shied away from making these kinds of statements. But if by intuition and perseverance and, you know, just real sort of painterly empiricism, you arrive there, it matters less whether you intended to or not than that you did. So I have the privilege of a curator and art historian say, she did, that these are the forces in play. I think, in fact, she knew exactly what she was doing, but it is not as if she wrote a program for it, it's just the fact that she achieved it. So what you have here is this move from sort of topological, from Euclidean spaces to topological spaces. You also have in this a sort of tightly bound form, rotate, it's like a racetrack form. And here in this painting called Pink Spiral Leap, it's almost as if this tension has been broken by letting the spring release inside the frame. Here again, if you think of Bob Mangold, of the paintings where he would make a rectangle and notch it, and then he would let the curve, you know, round out, but then skip, you can see a very interesting dialogue, but an entirely different affect, an entirely different way of experiencing that kind of pictorial situation. And then over here, you can see that the same thing is beginning to happen, but the curves are filling in. They are becoming planar. They can be both, in this case, sort of biomorphic by their contour, but they are also flat planes of color. And in this, she has a certain relationship to Stuart Davis, to Patrick Henry Bruce, and other American painters of the 20s and 30s, with this wonderful little corkscrew thing, which is a variation on this and a variation on this. What you've also seen is a woman who is operating in the margins of the mainstream, discovering the power of her idea and immediately scaling up to meet the demand of the work itself, and also to realize that to make herself space within the painterly discourse, she has to push some of the adjacent paintings aside and give full voice to what it is that she's found. So that's how far we've gotten, and dead ahead is the proof. You're getting a lot of talk at front, and I'm going to cut you loose in just a minute, both because you have to go someplace and where I do, but at least what you've got is a version of the way of thinking about this show when you come back on your own. We're not going to make the whole route, but I'll sort of anticipate what we're going to see a little bit. This painting is called Join, and this has most of the characteristics of the early phase in full statement. You have two forms which are similar in characteristic, but not, in fact, identically symmetrical. You have the point where they meet, which never, in fact, locks in. You have subdivisions of those two shapes, so that you have red to green, but in opposite situations. So the symmetry is broken by color, it's broken by position, it's broken by contour, but it is also suggested by all those same properties. And then here you have the opposition of the red, the white and the black, which are like two vibrating strings, but not parallel to one another. And then you have the fact these are actually really two panels, and so you have the additional line provided by the seam. So everything about this painting is about how it should, in a sense, bond, and everything at the same time explains how it, in fact, will not. How it is always in play, how it is always unstable. It is painted in very heavy paint. It has a physicality that is entirely, by this time, Elizabeth's own. It is a way in which she injects the body as much into the pigment as she does into the image, or alludes to the body as much as in terms of the touch and feel of the surface as in terms of all of these curvilinear shapes. And again, all the way through the show, you're going to see situations where things, again, come together but don't. Sometimes they come together in a kind of nice nuzzle, but don't, in fact, merge. Sometimes they come together angrily or awkwardly, like, you know, like gears that don't mesh, or like things that are actually breaking apart rather than joining. There's a whole range of metaphors in how this is actually comes about, but it's predicated, like all really first-rate art, on simple basics. The simple basics which are then worked into very, very unexpected combinations. On this side, a further simplification and a further concentration, as is usually the case with simplifications. The old dynamic of the container and the contained. Here's the angular, shall we call it cubist shape. Here is the round, shall we call it biomorphic shape. Here is the biomorphic shape inside the cubist shape. Here is the cubist shape inside the biomorphic shape. Here they exchange a charge. I don't know exactly how much charge they exchange. But in any case, you have this again. You have this sort of pairing and opposition. And you have everything repeated and everything also separated and divided. It's an incredibly dynamic thing. It's like two parentheses working against each other. And again, the erotic dimension of it, which is fairly obvious, I would think, the erotic dimension is part of the whole dynamic, but it is suggested by shapes. It is not represented in an obvious way. She eventually comes back to representing the body in quite straightforward ways. But this stepping aside from representation, what she had done in her sort of early pop things, allows her to develop a formal language that means that when she comes back to it, what you see in the picture is not just the description of the situation, but the actual way in which forms work with each other or do not work with each other at a sort of higher level of understanding. This is called Painter's Progress, and you can see that what I try to describe fairly well. What you've got is a palette with two brushes. The palette is a blushing pink bodily thing. The brushes are blushing orange phallic things. But this is a woman's painting, so this is not exactly an homage to the male brush. Or maybe it is a claiming of the so-called phallus. I don't know. But anyway, there's lots of room to speculate on this in terms of the sexual politics of painting in the early 80s. Suffice it to say that by the early 80s, the sexual politics was basically guys with big brushes, big guys with big brushes. This is the return of Julian Schnabel, who painted in his bathing suit, which he probably shouldn't have done, and stand on beach and so on. So you had the heroicization, the re-heroicization of the male painter. So that when a woman claims those symbols and presents it in this physical and sort of manifest way, it's a kind of wonderful jujitsu in terms of the language of painting at that time. Needless to say, it was not fully understood at that point, not fully credited, but in retrospect, I would argue, as Amar Wallach has done in the Times and others, that perhaps the really first-rate painters of the neo-expressionist moment, although neither one of them are expressionists, will turn out to be Susan Rothenberg and Elizabeth Murray, not some of those other fellas whose stock is somewhat fallen, as things tend to fall back. In any case, you can see here the shards of the Cubist painting bound together in the way that I tried to suggest by what is essentially biomorphic surrealist forms. And it's this interaction of the two that binds this painting together, that holds it together in a provisional, if you will, homeostasis, but it's always at the point of maybe just exploding and spreading out. So the tension in her work is about will it or will it not cohere? Will the center hold or will the periphery bind, or will it in fact implode and fall apart and disperse, and will entropic forces take over? That's sort of as far as we get here, and then we can step into the next room. This essentially is a fillet, almost, of the show that was done in 1988. Some of the paintings you've seen, Painter's Progress, Children Meeting, Beginner, were also in that exhibition. But this is the core of what was shown, or if not the core, the sort of the apogee of what was shown, with the exception of this painting, which was not in that exhibition. And this is literally the turning point or the corner on which she pivoted as she left that particular period, and I'll talk about it in a second. But at this point, you can see clearly, as it already happens in Painter's Progress, you can see that images do return and that these images are incredibly dynamic, large, et cetera, et cetera. They belong to a genre, and the genre is still life. And the still life genre, by and large, is a genre dedicated to the proposition that if, in fact, in other areas, landscape painting, romantic landscape painting in particular, which tends or often presents nature as something of a force of its own, if not a dramatic, cataclysmic force of its own, or traditional scenes of battle and conflict in history painting, that the domestic reality is under the control of the artist. It is the one domain in which a certain kind of order can be established. It can be very classical or it can be very Baroque, but it is order nonetheless. The pieces are arranged by the artist, who then is at leisure to study them and paint them as long as he or she wishes to create that sense of the harmony of part to part and of the internal dynamic of the picture. There are exceptions, of course. Manet may put a cat about ready to pounce on something in one of his pictures. Cézanne's pictures actually tend to slip off one side or forward when you don't want them to, but they never actually get there. There are all kinds of instabilities built into still life painting, but by and large, things hold their place. You can tell already that in this room, that is not the case. Here we have a dog erupting underneath the table who is about to turn everything, ass over tea kettle. In here, you have a series of wine glasses, coffee cups, beer glasses, tables, and so on and so forth, that are breaking up, tipped over. And in terms, again, of the sexual politics of all of this, this is the case of a woman painting the domestic environment. And when these paintings were made, people would often talk about them in those terms. However, by comparison to Cézanne, and as Elizabeth pointed out, nobody ever talked about Cézanne being a domestic painter. In the pejorative sense of the term. But compared to Cézanne, these are really in a state of complete turmoil in a way that his are not. So what she does is she takes the expected subject matter and inverts it in every possible way, kicks everything out, kicks the jams out, kicks the supports out, and gives still life painting a heroic, or maybe if you want to see it this way, anti-heroic but grand scale. Just to give you a sort of segue too, in that painting over there, which is called Deeper Than Bee, you have a chair and you have a ray of light. It is essentially the same situation as the Cézanne painting. Here, Madame Cézanne has disappeared entirely, and the ray of light simply strikes the empty chair. In the Cézanne painting, it's an ironic commentary on the muse and the artist. In this case, it's actually an homage to her mother, who had just died or was dying at that time. So the same vocabulary, which in one case provides a kind of humorous aside, in another category becomes the vessel, really, for a very powerful emotion. But she retains and shows by retaining it that caricature and comic strips can, in fact, convey those kinds of emotions. That expressionism is a rhetorical style of uncontrolled purgative emotion, but that caricature and exaggeration of other kinds can accomplish the same ends without necessarily pretending to be naturally that way, but can acknowledge their artifice and therefore in some ways complicate the whole question of what is being expressed and what the form of that expression actually is and how the artist controls it. In this case, you have the next phase, so to speak, of the whole proposition. This is called Don't Be Cruel, and it's based on the Elvis Presley song as a title. In most cases, her titles come late. She doesn't paint to the title, but in a sense, titles from the painting. But here you have the unified plane of cubism being fractured under the stress of this thing that looks a little bit like a silly putty or a rubber blanket or, you know, whatever. You have these rubbery legs, which are a further use of the cartoon kind of characters, almost silly symphony, early Disney-esque kind of animation. And then you have a situation where the actual structure loops the loop. So that you get a spatial paradox of a sort that I have at least never seen before. In this case, the structure comes out. The image is the image of the leg underneath the table, and it is painted, in a sense, back into the space that comes out. So you really are caught coming and going in both cases. And actually here you see the underside of the leg, which is ideally, or conceptually speaking, projecting back in space this way. Here also you see the underside of the leg, the bottom of the leg, that is coming not, it should be going this way, but it's actually come this way. Now, not only can she do this because she's done it, in a sense, you know, the answer is that, yeah, sure, I can do that. But in some other fundamental ways, and I don't want to get sort of very philosophical about it, but this is closer to the way space is, if we are to believe modern physics, than the old diagrammatic, blocked out, gridded out space. Space is full of convolutions and reversals, if we cue to the idea that black holes make any sense, and so on and so forth. So this kind of free movement through space, which is not intended to describe the way it is out there in deep space, nonetheless has some sense of what the actual polymorphousness of space can be and what presumably the polymorphousness of objects might be in the extreme. There's no painting like this prior to this. And what she does from here on out is begin to build further. And in this way, I think I've got time just to give you one or two details, and maybe I'll let you just sort of wander thereafter. But Elizabeth is not a sculptor. She is not interested in making sculpture. She's interested in making surfaces that will take paint different ways and which will complicate the reading of the image because of how they're structured. She's also not a carpenter by nature. Most of these complicated things that she builds, and they get much more so and more volumetric, are based on maquettes that she would make out of clay, which would then be boxed out and built by carpenters. In the first instance, Bob Moskowitz, who was her friend, built some of them, and I think he did Deeper Than Deep. He did certainly some of the earlier ones, the shaped flat ones. But by the time this happens, her studio assistant is a young Middlebury College student named Bob Gober. And there is a wonderful dialogue between Gober and Elizabeth that happens around this time as he is just beginning to break into his own work as an artist and as a sculptor. And it shows the ways in which intergenerational communication really does happen in the art world. A lot of people miss that. And now the art world is not structured that way. People come in you know, generational phalanxes practically. But in the days of the 70s and 80s, when the art community was comparatively speaking small and fluid, you had these wonderful meetings of minds and generations and so on. So what you're seeing is not Gober's invention, but it is at the same time something aided by his skill, and it is the beginning of, as I say, an aesthetic transgenerational dialogue that continues in lots of different dimensions. For the sake of, didacticism, but I hope not too heavy-handed, this is a painting from 1971. Which is Elizabeth's version of what exactly? A beer on the bar at Magoo's or any one of the finales, any one of the places one might have drunk beer at that time. It is also very plainly a response to early cubism. And particularly with this kind of coloration, it has a lot more to do with Juan Gris than it does with the analytic cubism of Picasso and of Braque. It's very heavily painted. What you see here in irregularities are actually lumps of pigment that stick out. And when you go two rooms farther, you're going to see enormous canvas with a kind of bell glass, it's hard to say what, upturned. And then there's a red thing that wobbles around through and goes off the sides. And on the sides, there's actual pigment built out so that although that's not a shaped canvas, there are these little extra additions of pigment, okay, that happen, which are precursors, or the precursors of which are here, in a way. But the other thing is that this image here, basically, is that image there, which is another painting from the 80s. And that image there becomes this image here, and then this image here. So, from the glass as domestic object in a household that is chaotic the way real households mostly are, that glass becomes basically another kind of vessel, which is the womb. And it becomes a, you know, pregnancy, insemination, what have you. All of these things become metaphoric in other dimensions. And it's around this time that Elizabeth is also having her two daughters by a second marriage. So this is attached to life experience in real ways. But what I want to point out to you is the business of how, again, intuition and empiricism work. That painting over there is a charming painting. It's a lovely painting. But you would never guess from that painting that you could get here. Furthermore, you could never have reasoned in the manner of American-style 60s formalism from that painting to this painting. The reason that Elizabeth is so interesting is she went places she was not supposed to go by paths that nobody knew existed. And there's a quote that I use in the catalog, which is from Ezra Pound's ABCs of Reading. He says, men, and I just put a little W-O in front of it to sort of correct his sexual bias, but he says, men of genius, or I would say women of genius, are always discovering laws of art that academics had mislaid or hidden. Okay? And essentially that's what Elizabeth has done. She has found her way to options that none of the extrapolations of formalist discourse in the 60s or 70s would have ever gotten you to. She did it by detours. And to quote another friend of mine, Peter Sheldahl, he used to say, you can tell a really serious artist because they don't go from A to B to C, they go from A to Z back to D by way of C. You're always zigzagging and you're always doubling back and you're always picking up loose pieces in order to make the whole proposition roll forward a little bit. So in this case, you have a little tiny, very, very interesting, but in a sense unambitious painting with 10 years delay becoming an incredibly ambitious painting by way of what you've seen and then what you see after that, which is basically flat and planar, this, which is entirely volumetric. And where it's cartoon, it's also grotesque, it's also overbearingly big and slightly frightening. It's also very, very beautiful. It has a certain kind of Brancusi-esque contour to it, but it has a lumpiness which Brancusi does not have, and it has the color has an intensity which you will not find, and so on down the line. When you get to this one here, you actually have spray painting, spray can painting. You have these little sort of things that look like ribbons that are breaking, and they also turn into little hands. You have all of this kind of, again, womb, birth canal stuff going on. But remember one other piece of the puzzle, which is bubble writing. Graffiti in New York changed in the 80s. It went from generally kind of angular graffiti to this wonderful, bulbous, curvilinear kind of graffiti that we see all around us today. And Elizabeth is one of those people who picked up on what that meant and transformed it dimensionally and incorporated it into her art. So if you think about graffiti as an art form, I'm not saying that Elizabeth is a graffiti artist, but this is a case where the vernacular on the streets clearly fed into and was reinterpreted by an artist who had arrived at almost the same place on her own. Okay. Sure. Okay, we can drift as you ask. Walk and talk. Yeah. It's Robert Mangold, actually, by Bob. Yeah.
What about the relationship between her and Lee Montague at this point?
Not exactly, because she wasn't particularly aware of Montague, but I would say roughly this, and it's in the catalog also. I would say that she is a maker of specific objects. That what Judd did in incorporating Montague was to say that there are certain things that are at a tense midpoint between painting and sculpture, and that Montague was one of those people. This is really painting, I think, but it has enough of the sculptural dimension that if you think of her in relation to Montague, not as an inspiration, as Montague was for Eva Hesse, but rather as a parallel discourse that can give you some insight into what, you know. I mean, for example, there are holes in her. Yeah. But that one is likely to burp and Monica's won't burp.
Are there any artists that you think continue her legacy, her dynamism, her invention? Is there anyone you can think of today?
Well, she's doing something, Julie's doing something different. I think that Tip Dunham is involved in things.
Is involved in things
that are related to this. Jim Nutt, who was a contemporary of hers at the Art Institute of Chicago, has developed it without the dimensional side, but very much
like 80s, 90s. How about right now?
Well, I see them as right now. I don't believe paintings.
I know.
I'm sorry. I mean, whoever is making the paintings for real now is now, and some of them are younger and some of them are older. I mean, Elizabeth's 65, so she's as now as. I mean, Jim's only about 2 years older than she is, so you know. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Frank Stella is somebody that she thought about a lot. I don't think she thought about Bontecou very much, although she recognizes her as a significant person. There's another painter who I didn't mention named Ron Gorchoff, who she does recognize and to whom she owes an admitted debt. In the 60s into the 70s, there were a lot of people grappling with how do you get off the wall, and she's part of that whole tendency. But I would say Bontecou is not really involved in painting except by analogy, because she uses grommets and ropes and things like that to create the effects of marks and drips and so on, but she's really a sculptor, whereas...
Well, what's also true is she's more figurative than Stella or Bontecou.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, that's what amazed me about seeing this show, is that I didn't realize she was so figurative in this abstract way.
Although Bontecou is quite figurative in some dimensions, and actually I wrote for the Bontecou catalog and was involved in bringing the show here, and one of the reasons I wanted it here was to help flesh out those histories. But I, at the same time, don't want to make them too tight. I mean, they're like planets rotating in relation to each other, but they're not. Neither one is the sun or the moon to the other.
One question. Yeah. Can you address the transition from this body of work to what she's done in the last few years?
I can't, I'm afraid I have to run. Basically, I think what she decided was that she wanted to break away from the structure and be allowed to paint without having to build every time. And I think she wanted to give herself more room to maneuver so that these paintings, rather than having a unified structure on which you paint, are actually built of pieces that she can rearrange pretty much at will. So that this painting here, the outer thing, the orange-red or the orange-yellow, the blue, the green, and that little orange man, weren't even in the painting until two-thirds or three-quarters of the way for the painting to do. And periodically she'll just pull something out of it and put it in a different position. So it allows her to compose according to a different mechanism.